The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And over the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the National Geographic Traveler and AAA Go magazine. Before we begin, let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, excursions, safaris, what have you, that might be featured in our readings. However, we do select them for your enjoyment and edification. On today's Armchair Traveler, our journey is going to begin with Sun, Sea, Savor from the February-March 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. Writer David Farley explains how Croatian charisma and a feast of flavors are brining in Europe's next great dining destination. My friend Maria Papak, a born and bred Dubrovnik denizen, is about to open a street food stall in her Croatian hometown with a focus that is surprisingly radical for this coastal city, hyper-seasonal and super-local snacks. I am shadowing her on a tour of area farms to forage for hard-to-find artisanal cheese, sausage, and other Dalmatian delights. First stop, the farm of Marko Beti and his wife, Jila, outside the village of Lisak, lodged up in the steep hills of the Dalmatian coast about an hour's drive north of Dubrovnik. Before we get down to business sampling products from the farm, the Beatys want to see if a New Yorker can milk a farm animal. Gamely, I pull again and again at a goat's udder. Nothing. Not even a squirt of milk. As a farmer, I'm a failure. But as a lover of Dalmatian food, I'm in exactly the right place. Phrases like farm to table, snout to tail, locavore, and other parlance of the new food movement that has transformed tables throughout the world in the last decade have only just sauntered through southeastern Europe. I've been traveling regularly to Dubrovnik for the last decade and a half, and I could never really understand why restaurant food here has always been so mediocre. Flaccid fried calamari, overbaked pizza, staid pasta dishes. Then again, take one glance at Dubrovnik and you'll realize that this eye candy of a town doesn't need to serve good food to attract visitors. The indigo Adriatic Sea and its alluring beaches form the backdrop for a balmy medieval town lined with glistening white limestone paved streets and encircled by 80-foot stone walls. Starring roles in the Games of Thrones and Star Wars, The Last Jedi, have also helped put the city on the 21st century grand tour itinerary. I've always wondered if Dubrovnik's inability to keep pace with culinary trends has roots in the communist period when Croatia was part of Yugoslavia, or was it the war that ravaged the Balkan region 25 years ago? Or something else. The good news, Dubrovnik's dining landscape is changing quickly. The city recently welcomed its first artisanal coffee spot called Cojito, a series of cocktail bars including Bar by Azur, its inaugural craft brewery, Dubrovnik Beer Company, and its first roaming pop-up restaurant, Gypsy Table. But a group of young food-obsessed people are taking it into their own hands to make a change in the way people eat here. Is this the food revolution I've been waiting for? Moreover, are Dubrovnik and the surrounding Dalmatian coast, which stretches 340 miles from Rab Island in Croatia to Kotor in Montenegro, on the verge of becoming Europe's next great dining destination? One of the key players, I quickly learn, is Maria Papak herself. I first met Maria in December 2016 during the city's month and a half-long winter festival. As I walked down Straden, the main thoroughfare of the fully predestinized old town, the scent of grilled sausages mingled with briny oysters and Croatian folk tunes seeped from speakers affixed to roofs. I'd had my fill of mollusk and meat, offered at nearly every food stand. But then I came across Maria's stand, which served classic Dalmatian fare with a twist. She used artisanal products she'd found by scouring villages up and down the coast. She even sold something called a sea egg. When I asked her about food, she glowed with passion. Her goal, she told me, was to bring real food to the people of this city, to reintroduce them to the dishes their great-grandparents ate, which was still being purveyed in tucked-away villages. She loathed the fact that so many of her Dubrovnik friends had come to rely on two major supermarket chains, Pemo and Konsum, sprinkled around town. She wanted to acquaint them with a better way of eating. "You should come with me to meet some of these villagers," she said. And so, here I am, 6 months later, trying to milk a goat. I am soon relieved of my duties, and we all gravitate into the farmhouse for an Epicurean feast. A few days later, we're at it again. This time, we're in her car, snaking through the back roads in the fertile Konovo Valley in the hills southeast of Dubrovnik. As our car twists and turns, Maria tells me more about her forthcoming street food stall. "Wild asparagus," she says, "is actually in season for about 10 days. I'll only serve it for those 10 days, then I'll move on to whatever is in season next." When Maria and I pull into the village of Mihanol, she tells me we are visiting one of her favorite farmers to try out some of his cheeses and cured meats. Within minutes of arriving at the home of 51-year-old Miho Kukajilika, his wife Kate is filling our glasses with homemade Travalika, a grape brandy infused with local herbs. We raise our glasses and toast Javili to life and then down the hatch. Their long wooden table fills up with soft, grassy-tasting one-day-old cheese, one-month-old cheese, and cheese marinated in olive oil. Then there are the pork products, overflowing plates of pancetta, prosciutto, thick slices of sausage, all derived from the fatty Pata Negra pig. There are fluffy slices of country bread, bottles of olive oil and pickled peppers, carafes of Chardonnay and a red blend of Shiraz, Merlot, and Cabernet Sauvignon materialize, along with jugs of wild nut and cherry liqueur. Even more remarkable is when Miho says, "I made everything on this table," waving his hand across it like some kind of culinary wizard. He isn't boasting, he's just stating a fact. This is a meal by a gastronomic superman. He sells his products out of his home, but is currently converting his garage into a small shop. "I sell everything I produce, and I sell it before I can even make it," he tells me, as I let a piece of prosciutto melt in my mouth, its salty taste lingering on my tongue long after I swallow it. Miho hasn't always had this level of success. In the last few years, business has picked up. I think people here are finally starting to realize that the food we small farmers produce, and there are only a few of us left here in Konoval, is not only better food, but it's better for the community to support us, he says. If we could only hire some help, he'd be able to produce more, but everyone here wants to work in the tourism industry. Back in Dubrovnik, I stop in for lunch at Pantarul, located in the Lapad area of the city, opened by food writer Anna Maria Bushek. Pantarul offers a modern, global take on traditional Dalmatian fare. As I savor a fava bean and octopus risotto, fava beans being in season at the moment, and a wild herb flatbed that is mostly found on the nearby islands of Vis, Anna Maria stops by my table. At first, our intention was to serve only locally produced seasonal ingredients we could get from the main food market in Dubrovnik and local producers, she says. But we soon realized that wasn't possible in Dubrovnik. She admits that only 80% of what's on the plate is from small farmers. When Pantarul opened in 2014, its approach was revolutionary for the city. "It usually takes one restaurant to do something, and then others will follow," Anna Maria says. And she's right. Since then, a handful of inspired new restaurants, including Glory Jet, Amphora, and Local in the nearby town of Zopa, have followed Pantarul's lead. Pantarul also differed from the typical Dubrovnik restaurant by catering to a local clientele. There's so much focus on feeding the tourist industry here, but that's now changing. A younger generation is becoming increasingly interested in good food. Our weekend brunch, for example, is almost all locals. 50 miles up the coast from Dubrovnik, on the rustic Pelješac Peninsula, I discover where the Dalmatian food movement may be percolating the most. Marina Ragus, an active member of the local Slow Food Convivium, is the glue that holds Pelješac's culinary community together. Along with her parents, she runs the food-centric Villa Vatican, located in the seaside village of Trapani. She promises to take me around. At Crocatino in the town of Orlebeck, we eat organic ice cream infused with local ingredients like thyme and mint. The 29-year-old Maria Antonovic foraged in the hills. When I asked why people are only now starting to pay attention to better food, Maria points to the wars of the early 1990s. It helps that my generation was not really as affected by the war. We are more open to the future. When my father was my age, the war began at what should be one of the most beautiful times in one's life. His brother was killed in the war. My generation doesn't have that burden. Later that day, we sip organic wine, a robust, fruity red, at Kritz Winery. People here thought we were crazy for going organic when we first started, says owner Dennis Bogjevic Marusik. A generation or two ago, it was normal, but now most wineries here just use pesticides. My grandparents made organic wine. It was the way you did it. His wife, Marietta Kalek, recently helped bring back Veronik, a thick molasses-like sweetener made from the local Plavac Malai grape. With the help of Slow Food, she and three other winemakers now produce it. This local product was used to sweeten food. It disappeared a couple of generations ago, but we've brought it back, and now three chefs in Brodnik are using it in their food, she notes. Marana, my guide, adds, Veronik is a perfect example of how we need to have pride in our food. Dubrovnik is such a tourist-driven city, and we just give tourists pizza and pasta because we think that's what they want. Kritz Wineries, Marietta, says that the sluggish pace of change has roots in the communist period. We lived in fear someone was going to tell the authorities we were doing something wrong. Tourists will certainly benefit from the changes happening in the Dubrovnik food scene, but Dalmatians themselves will be the biggest beneficiaries. In eating well, they are also connecting with a forgotten heritage. That's the thing, Marana says. We've always been slow food. We were before slow food existed. Hopefully soon more people will realize this is the true Dalmatian way of eating. Well, travel writer David Farley is the author of An Irreverent Curiosity and a forthcoming book, Underground Worlds, A Guide to Spectacular Subterranean Places. And accompanying his National Geographic Traveler article is a sidebar, Travel-Wise Dubrovnik, which offers some tips if you're planning to visit the Croatian community, like where to stay, Hotel Bellevue, situated on the cliffs overlooking the Adriatic Sea. This five-star spot is a quick 15-minute walk to Dubrovnik's old town. Hungry visitors don't have to go far to find good food here, as the in-house restaurant Vapor serves just pulled from the sea fish and upscale Dalmatian dishes. And you can learn more about Hotel Bellevue at AdriaticLuxuryHotels.com, AdriaticLuxuryHotels.com. Then there's One Suite Hotel, and that's S-U-I-T-E, One Suite Hotel. This new property consists entirely of one- and two-bedroom suites located in the town of Zopa, about 5 miles south of Dubrovnik. These stylish digs made for a good base to explore the Konava Valley. The top-notch in-house restaurant, Lokal, cooks up Dalmatian dishes with ingredients procured from local farms. And OneSuiteHotel.com gets you more information online, OneSuiteHotel.com. Then we have Villa Vatican, located in the small, charming seaside town of Trapani. This 200-year-old stone villa that was once inhabited by a priest, hence the name, is run by Lenka and Joe Ragus, who prepare for guests some of the tastiest home-cooked meals this side of the Adriatic. And then there's not to miss city walls. Dubrovnik's medieval city walls are among the best preserved in Europe. Extending for some 1.25 miles, they rise to a height of 82 feet in places and are up to 20 feet thick. Your Dubrovnik city walls tickets also get you into the St. Lawrence's Fortress, which will be a familiar setting for Game of Thrones fans. Well, Dubrovnik Summer Festival is the 69th annual festival held from July 10th to August 25th this year. Schedules a spectacular roster of music, opera, theater, and dance performances. Events take place in historic settings in Dubrovnik's old town. World-class artists that have performed in the past include the likes of London's Old Vic and the Cincinnati Symphony. And you can learn more about this Dubrovnik Summer Festival at Dubrovnik.com. Dubrovnik-festival.hr. Dubrovnik, Dubrovnik-festival.hr. Wow. Well, from Dubrovnik in Eastern Europe, we are going to Normandy, to the West, which will celebrate the 75th anniversary of the Normandy invasion in 2019. Writer L.A. Jackson previews what visitors can expect in Remembering Normandy, published in the January-February 2018 issue of AAA Go magazine. Sword, Juno, Gold, Utah, Omaha. It's hard to separate these five names, even after nearly three-quarters of a century has passed, linking them to the beaches in the northwestern French region of Normandy. D-Day is the historical connection, and June 6, 1944, is the precise date when the combined troops of America, Canada, England, and other Allied countries crashed against Nazi Germany's formidable Atlantic Wall. The result was a crack hammered into Germany's fortress Europe that led to the Third Reich's downfall less than a year later. We begin with historic sites. The guns have long been silenced, but the memories remain, memories that certainly will be rekindled in 2019, which will be the 75th anniversary of the landings at Normandy. Knowing this important tick in time was approaching drew me to the English Channel of France in search of age-worn whispers that remain from those distant days of desperate rage. After considering many options, I settled on an 8-day Viking River Cruises itinerary billed as Paris and the Heart of Normandy. It turned out to be a good choice, not only because of the tour's Normandy beach experience, but also for the unexpected extras tied to the historic event that I discovered along the way on a slow, pleasant trip west from Paris down the winding Seine River. What I did expect, of course, was a quality trip, and the Viking Catalan with her able crew of 50 delivered. Being a river cruiser, Catalan is a four-decker just over a football field and a challenging field goal long, 443 feet, with 95 cabins for a maximum of 190 passengers. After a two-day stay in Paris for passengers to enjoy the city, Catalan's first stop down the scenic Seine was, for me, the beginning of what was. We docked in the small city of Brennan, and just after stepping off the ship, I spotted a modest limestone plaque that commemorated a battle fought by the British 43rd Wessex Division 2 months after D-Day. To continue chasing the retreating Germans toward Belgium, the British constructed three floating bridges across the Seine. The battle to drive out the Germans and the bridge's construction lasted 3 days at a cost of 550 British casualties. Our next port of call was Rouen, a storied medieval town founded by the Gauls and home to the iconic Rouen Cathedral. I explored the many cozy streets lined with half-timbered houses built in the Middle Ages. I noticed that there were very few of these structures and many more modern buildings between the Rouen Cathedral and the Seine River. Our guide informed me of another World War II connection. Rouen was taken over by the Germans in the spring of 1940. When a fire broke in the old part of the city, firemen were blocked from fighting the blaze for 2 days, resulting in a charred landscape replacing centuries of history from the rivers to the cathedral. From Rouen, we took a two-hour bus ride to the Normandy beaches, stopping first in the small coastal town of Arromanches, which was an important disembarkation point for the Allies after the initial landings. Dotting the shallow waters beyond the town are many massive pieces of a puzzle famously known as Mulberry Harbor that, although meant to be temporary, stand like timeless sentinels, still resisting being claimed by the Atlantic. Sobering reminders. A World War II museum in Arromanches helps visitors connect with the beach landing's history to the humanity that spilled upon them during the invasion. In the same area, scattered outdoor displays of military hardware add to the educational experience. Located across a parking lot from the museum stood a formerly formidable German 88 artillery piece reduced to guarding a small outdoor park for board games, while camouflaged by a basket of petunias. Proof that time can tame even even the deadliest things. More heavy metal was on display at our next destination, just outside the French village of Langres-sur-Mer, where a cluster of four massive German 152-millimeter coastal guns, each housed in heavily reinforced bunkers, still point out to the sea. Located between the Gold and Omaha landing areas, they poured shells onto Allied ships approaching the beaches. Three were put out of action on June 6th. The last was captured the following day. Visitors less attracted to the historical importance of the D-Day landings might think of this part of the Viking cruise as just a rust-and-dust excursion. However, for many, such a notion will be quickly dispelled as the tour's next stop, the Normandy American Cemetery and Memorial. On a cliff overlooking Omaha Beach, this 172-acre hallowed site cradles the remains of 9,387 Americans who were killed during the landings and follow-up operations. Their lives replaced by simple white markers, all lined in precision rows, each a quiet testament to the toll taken. Touching tribute. As a nice addition, the Catlins program director arranged a small ceremony for our group in the embrace of the memorial's semicircle colonnade. After a short speech, the Star-Spangled Banner was softly played, followed by taps, with its final note hanging long in the clear blue sky. Very simple, very powerful. Finally, it was on to Omaha Beach itself, where some of the worst fighting of the invasion took place. On June 6, 1944, it was a death layer of minefields, barbed wire, tank traps, and crossfires, but all of that is now gone. Today, the beach is a popular sun and surf spot for locals and tourists. Guns have been replaced by skim boards, frisbees, and ice cream cones. In the middle of this recreational mecca stands a large commemorative stone monolith flanked by an equally impressive sculpture of stainless steel wings entitled Le Brave, or Le Brave, both marking their point where war history forever changed. Occasionally, they are noticed, but often they're just passed by. This nonchalance sometimes cast on those Omaha Beach monuments stayed in the mind of the Catlins' two-day return journey to Paris. But then it occurred to me that even though they, like the landing site, have now become part of a holiday beach, maybe in simple terms, that's what D-Day was all about. A fight to return to normal. And with that slight observation, in singular satisfying conclusion came to my victory. Well, I suspect that someone is going to say, let's go to the movies, and may readily think a favorite theater, possibly boasting that sound and projection technology that you read so much about, along with stadium seating, of course. Well, Virginia Brown offers yet another destination for moviegoers in her article, Movie Night Out, this in the March-April issue of AAA Go magazine. And she tells us that the nostalgia of drive-ins thrives in the Carolinas. Are you ready for this one? At the bottom of a hill, a monster movie screen rises 50 feet high along South Battleground Avenue, a well-intentioned sore thumb in a clearing among a perimeter of tall oaks. King's Mountain, off in the distance, creates an idyllic panorama for a film set in its own right. We're at Hound's Drive-In in Kings Mountain, North Carolina, thin white post partition off spaces where dozens of cars will park, row after row and stadium style for tonight's feature. The movie will start at dusk. The car radio's tuned to 88.1. The radios are also for rent for $5, cash only. Simple staples like barbecue and bologna burgers outshine standards like popcorn, a small tub runs $2, and hot dogs. Slim Jims, cotton candy, and nachos also make the concessions cut. Each is served with a side of Times Gone By, a time before smartphones tracked every step, and reminded us of where we're supposed to be at every moment. Drive-in theaters were introduced in Camden, New Jersey in 1933 when Richard Hollingshead sought to create a more comfortable movie-going experience. Noticing the success of the drive-in restaurant, he furthered the concept to include Hollywood hits. By the 1940s, order at your car concessions proved more popular than waiting in long popcorn lines with patrons perturbed by missing parts of the featured film. Greensboro, North Carolina drive-ins trailblazed in the 1950s, offering moviegoers a way to simply push a button on the side of the car speaker to summon a car hop, who would return with requisite RC colas and moon pies for a small fee. But the convenience, comfort, and affordability of this newly exploding entertainment option saw its biggest growth at the height of the baby boom. By 1958, the drive-in theater count in the U.S. was 4,063. Today, that number is closer to 300 nationwide. Over 1,000 screens closed between 1978 and 1988, and in the 1990s, there were fewer than 600 drive-ins left in the U.S., over 3,000 defunct from just several decades earlier. Like the roller coaster rink or swing dance halls, the drive-in theater lives on in some rural pockets of the Carolinas. From Beaufort to Eden, you can find them now just with more advanced digital projection systems. Hounds is just one of nine drive-ins operating seasonally across the region. The lot closed in late November and will reopen after winter thaws to spring. When warmer temperatures become a constant again in the Carolinas, consider a visit to one of these iconic outdoor gyms. Hey, and don't forget to bring the popcorn. Oh, my goodness. And speaking of which, there are some great picks for outdoor flicks, which are included with Virginia Brown's article. Here in North Carolina, we had the Baden Road Drive-In at 2411 Baden Road in Albemarle. Actually, you can go online and check them out, badenroaddrivein.com, badenroaddrivein.com, B-A-D-I-N. And then Eden Drive-In at 106 Fireman Club Road in Eden, North Carolina. And they also are online at edendrivein.com. Then we have Hounds Drive-In Theater at 114 Raven Circle, Kings Mountain, and houndsdrivein.com is how you find out more information online. And then there's the Raleigh Road Outdoor Theater. Don't get excited. This is not Raleigh. This is Raleigh Road Outdoor Theater at 3336 Raleigh Road in Henderson, just about an hour's drive away. That's RaleighRoadDriveIn.com for more information online. RaleighRoadDriveIn.com. And then the Sunset Drive-In Theater at 3935 Sunset Boulevard. That's in Shelby. And you can check them out at sunsetdriveintheater.com, sunsetdriveintheater.com. Now on to South Carolina, 25 Drive-In Theater. This one is at 3109 Highway 25 South in Greenwood, South Carolina. And you can check them out, the number 25, and then drivein.com, the number 25, drivein.com. Airport Drive-In Theater is located at 180 Log Cabin Road in Bowman, South Carolina. Highway 21 Drive-In, 55 Parker Drive, and that's off U.S. 21 in Beaufort, South Carolina. That's near the coast. And then you can check them out at hwy21drivein.com, highway21drivein.com. And then there's the Moneta Drive-In Theater, and this is at 5822 Columbia Highway in North Moneta. And you can check them out at thebigmo.com, thebigmo.com. So lots of fun to be had with some outdoor theater destinations for you coming up in the warmer climes. How about that? Well, how about some travel possibilities as we take a look at the March-April travel calendar? This, again, is featured in the same issue of the AAA Go magazine, which has just arrived in the mail recently. So let's take a look at what they have. On March 3rd, there was the Irish Fest at Camden, in downtown Camden, South Carolina. This family cultural event hosted live Irish music, dancing, food, and Highland games, and a leprechaun parade and more. And if you want to plan for next year's, you can go to Montessori-Camden.com for more information. That's Montessori-Camden.com. Now, on March 9th, we have the Young Islanders, or Irelanders, in downtown Lumberton, North Carolina. The group of eight Irish performers perform traditional Irish music, song, and dance, and there is a fee involved. Check it out at CarolinaCivicCenter.com, CarolinaCivicCenter.com. And that brings us to another end of another journey on today's Armchair Travel. We hope that you'll listen next time, that you've enjoyed your travels today. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at the website trianglereadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.